Welcome to Torah Imecha Nach Yomi with the OU's Women's Initiative. My name is Lynn Kraft, and today we will be learning Melachim Aleph Perek Zayin. This perek continues the description of the construction of the Beit HaMikdash, specifically the creation of the Kelim, the vessels that were used within it. However, before we hear a discussion of the Kelim, we seem to take a break from the description of the building of the Beit HaMikdash, and we hear instead about the building of Shlomo's palace. Interestingly, whereas the construction of the Beit HaMikdash took 7 years, the construction of Shlomo's palace took significantly longer, 13 years. Rashi explains that this was in fact a praise of Shlomo HaMelech, as he was more Mizdari's, enthusiastic and quick-acting, for the building of the Beit HaMikdash than for his own palace. The question, though, that we really have to ask is, why is the building of Shlomo's house or palace placed in the middle of the description of the building of the Beit HaMikdash? Why not first finish describing the construction of the Beit HaMikdash and then describe the construction of Shlomo's house? Why do we have to interrupt the construction of the Beit HaMikdash with a description of the construction of Shlomo's palace? Rav Menachem Liebtag suggests that the Navi places the description of Shlomo's construction of his own palace smack in the middle of his construction of the Beit HaMikdash to demonstrate that the kingdom of Israel is in the service of God. To further demonstrate this, Shlomo's palace was constructed very close to the Beit HaMikdash, but still lower than the Beit HaMikdash, which was located atop Har HaMoriah. However, this relationship only holds true as long as the king keeps Hashem's laws. If not, the kingdom will be destroyed. It is not surprising that Yirmiyahu makes sure this point gets across in Sefer Melachim, because this is a point that he will deal with for most of his prophetic career. After the description of Shlomo's palace and the construction thereof, we're told that Shlomo hires a copper artisan named Hiram from Tzor. But we're told that this Hiram's mother was from Shevet Dan, and his father was from Shevet Naphtali, but resided in Tzor for a long time. According to most Parshanim, this is not Hiram Melech Tzor, but another man from Tzor named Hiram, who happens to share the king's name. This copper artisan named Hiram made the following kelim, vessels out of copper, nechoshet, because he was a copper artisan. First, he designed the two pillars that stood outside the ulam, the entryway, the two amudim, and we're told that the two amudim were given names. The first amud's name was Yachin, and the second amud's name was Boaz. We're told that Hiram also designed special kotarot crowns for each of the amudim, which were decorated with checkerwork, chainwork, pomegranates, lilies, and some other beautiful designs. The Radak explains that Yachin was named to reflect Shlomo's hope that the Beit HaMikdash would be established Yachin forever, and Boaz was named to reflect his wish that Hashem would give within it strength, as a contraction of the two words, Bo-Oz, within it is strength. Hiram then designed the Yam, which was a large reservoir of water that we're told sat upon 12 copper oxen, three oxen facing in each of the four directions, north, east, south, and west. It seems that the Yam was the source of water for the Kiurim, for the basins, which we'll hear about in a moment. We're also told that Hiram created 10 michonot, which are described as square bases, each of which sat upon four wheels. So we have 10 square bases. Each square base had four wheels and was decorated with images of lions, oxen, and kruvim, cherubs. These bases were created for the 10 kirim, which were the basins of water, and we're told that the kirim rested upon the michonot. Each kiur rested upon one michona. What's interesting is that of this list, only the kiurim sound familiar to us from the Mishkan. All the other copper kelim were unique and new in the Beit HaMikdash. Following the design of the copper kelim, we're told of the design of the golden kelim. We're told that Shlomo had the Mizbeach HaZahav created. We're told that he had the Shulchan created. But in Divrei Hayamim, it's described that in fact Shlomo had not one but 10 Shulchanot built for the Beit HaMikdash. And finally, we're told that Shlomo had 10 menorot created. And according to Rashi, these were built in addition to the original menorah that Moshe had built for the Mishkan. which was also placed in the Beit HaMikdash for a total of 11 menorot. It's important to note that Shlomo created at least 10 times as many menorot, shulchanot, and kiurim, candelabras, tables, and basins for the Beit HaMikdash as there were in the Mishkan. And the question we can ask is, why would Shlomo do that? Why would he feel the need to create 10 times as many vessels of these particular vessels for the Beit HaMikdash than there were in the Mishkan? So there are those who answer this question practically. The Meshech Chachma explains that Shlomo created 10 menorot because the Beit HaMikdash was so much larger than the Mishkan, and therefore the Beit HaMikdash needed 10 times the light in order to provide enough illumination. The Yalkut Shimoni explains that the reason why Shlomo constructed 10 Shulchanot and Kiurim was because they were a larger nation now. And the fact that Bnei Yisrael were so much larger now than they had been in the Midbar in the desert, they practically just needed more bread and more water in order to properly serve Hashem in the Beit HaMikdash. There were more Kohanim, there were more members of Bnei Yisrael coming to serve God, and therefore they needed more bread on the Shulchan, they needed more water in the Yam and in the Kiurim. Rav Alex Israel suggests, based on what we've learned so far about Shlomo's kingdom, that just as everything in Shlomo's kingdom was done on a grander scale than usual, so too the Beit HaMikdash, which was Shlomo's greatest project, was also done on a grander scale. As we conclude the description of the construction of the Beit HaMikdash in this parak, it behooves us to ask a general question on all the details and specifications provided. Really, why do we need to be given such detail about the building of the Beit HaMikdash? Do we really need to know all the specific measurements and intricate designs of each of the kelim, the walls, everything seems to have, we didn't go through all the specific measurements beyond those of the Kruvim and the Kodesh HaKodeshim, but every single time that another aspect of the Beit HaMikdash is described, we're told the specific measurements, we're told the specific designs. Why are we told so much detail? Rav Menachem Liebtag suggests that the reason for all of its details is that the Beit HaMikdash symbolizes the connection between man and God. And since the Beit HaMikdash is a symbol of our relationship with Hashem, every single last detail counts, just as it does in our following of the Torah. A further question can be asked as well. Why do we so heavily emphasize physical beauty in a place where we're supposed to be focused instead on spirituality? Might not the physical beauty take away from our lofty spiritual goals, right? We're coming to the Beit HaMikdash to serve Hashem. Why are we so focused on the physicality of what the Beit HaMikdash looked like and how beautiful it was if our entire purpose is to connect to God, who is beyond the physical and only spiritual? In this way, the description of the Mikdash, referring to both the Beit HaMikdash and the Mishkan, is actually not the first we hear of such intense spirituality being housed, so to speak, in such a physically beautiful place. In fact, the first time we're exposed to this apparent paradox is in Gan Eden, a place that is described as being of unblemished physical beauty, but was also supposed to be a place where man could most intimately connect to God in the world. And so we can ask a similar question of Gan Eden as we can of the Mikdash. Why did Hashem create such an intensely spiritual place with such intense physical beauty? Perhaps we can understand one answer based on the Malbim's understanding of the famous pasuk in Isha Chayil. Sheker achin vehevel hayofi, isha yirat Hashem, hi titalal. Physical favor and beauty are falsehoods and vanities. A woman who is God-fearing, she is praiseworthy. The Malbim suggests that this statement isn't necessarily meant to be one of contrast between physical beauty on the one hand and fear of God on the other hand, but rather the pasuk can be read as connecting the two, meaning that by themselves, physical graciousness is a falsehood. Beauty is a vanity. However, when the beautiful woman is God-fearing, then her beauty itself, the chin and yofi referred to in the beginning of the pasuk, he titalal, then even that chin and yofi, that physical beauty, is considered praiseworthy. This is why the Malbim explains the Imahot, our matriarchs, are all described as physically beautiful. Not because we think that physical looks are paramount, but rather because their outer beauty accurately reflected their internal beauty. And perhaps in this way, we can better understand the physical beauty of Gan Eden and the Mikdash. When people inside these places are worshiping Hashem correctly and connecting to Him on the highest possible level, then their high level of physical beauty becomes valuable as a reflection of the high level of spirituality contained within it. In other words, the external beauty of Gan Eden and the Mikdash accurately reflects the internal beauty and spirituality of the connection to Hashem taking place within them. Rav Hirsch suggests a slightly different answer on Bereishit Perek Bet Pasuk Tet, which describes Gan Eden. And he explains that physical beauty actually lends itself to reaching greater spiritual moral heights. He says, quote, "Joy in the beauties of nature and the beauties of form form a bridge towards what is spiritually and morally beautiful." He then goes on to discuss what has more recently become known in the world of psychology as the broken windows theory, which is basically that when a neighborhood is ugly and obviously not taken care of, has a lot of broken windows, everything seems to be kind of ignored, crime rates in those locations soar. And the reasoning behind it, the psychology behind it, is that when local thugs see broken windows, they assume that if no one's willing to fix broken windows, the area is not being carefully monitored, and so petty crimes will likely go unnoticed. And so it's worth the risk of, you know, doing the little stealing that they wanted to do. On the other hand, when attention is paid to beautifying the area, fixing the broken windows, cleaning up litter from the streets, the local thugs will realize that someone is now paying attention, and therefore it's not worth the risk of committing a crime. They say that this is how Harlem in New York City was gentrified, by just doing little things like cleaning up broken windows and litter from the streets. They were able to really decrease the crime rates in that area of New York City. And so in this way, being surrounded by physical beauty actually leads people to attitudes and behavior that reflect a greater spirituality and morality. And perhaps in this way, we can better understand the physical beauty of Gan Eden and the Beit HaMikdash. Due to their intense physical beauty, the people within them will hopefully be inspired to attain even greater spiritual and moral heights, connecting even closer with Hashem, not despite the physical beauty surrounding them, but perhaps even because of that very beauty. In fact, it is Rav Hirsch himself who suggests in his commentary to Bereishit Perek Gimel Pasuk Chaf Dalet that the road back to Gan Eden wasn't blocked by the Kruvim and the Lahat HaMitapechet. We're told that after Adam and Chava were kicked out of Gan Eden, Hashem placed cherubs and an ever-turning sword, Lishmor et Haderech. But Rav Hirsch says that instead of interpreting Lishmor as blocking the way so that no one could return there, he says rather we should interpret that word as to safeguard the way. That these objects, instead of blocking the way back to Gan Eden, safeguarded the way back to Gan Eden in order to guarantee that we would be able to return there. How on earth can we return to Gan Eden? Rav Hirsch notices that we never again see the term Lahat HaMitapechet in all of Tanakh, the ever-turning sword, but we do see the term Kruvim again in only one context, that of the Mikdash. The Kruvim there were placed upon the Aron Kodesh, which houses the Torah, in order to safeguard the Torah and make sure that Bnei Yisrael could and would return to, if not Gan Eden itself, then at least the spiritual state of Gan Eden, the ability to connect to Hashem again and again. In his words, quote, Kruvim protected the, quote, tree of life in the rejuvenated temporary paradise, the Mikdash. As here in Gan Eden, they kept the way to the tree of life that it should not be lost for mankind. In other words, the purpose of the Mikdash was to enable us to return to the spiritual state of Gan Eden, where we can connect to Hashem as intimately as possible. Perhaps this can further explain why the Beit HaMikdash was constructed with such an emphasis on physical beauty, to mirror the beauty of Gan Eden, the very place it's supposed to lead us back to, and to enable us to connect to Hashem as deeply as we can, in the same way as mankind did back then. Thank you for studying together, Li'iloi Nishmat, Malka Esther, Batzvi Yosef.